Prologue. All liberal commies are doomed to extinction, the old man croaked. They do not have the stomach to do what must be done to survive. They don't have the conviction to kill in the name of their beliefs. The right is rising. Not just in this country, but across North America. Right-thinking people here, and in Canada, and in Mexico, people with real family values, are shedding blood for their way of life. The speaker wore a pair of faded overalls and a flannel shirt that was barely visible beneath a gray, bushy beard that reached his navel. His roomy eyes shone with the light of a fanatic. He was the prophet speaking to his chosen people, preaching hatred and violence. And a prophet, he was. The extreme right was uniting all across North America, where its adherents crossed borders into these countries, often one step ahead of the federal authorities. It started small. A church burning in Maine, where the congregation had allowed a gay marriage. No one would link it to the reign of terror that would rock all three countries in the months to come, not at the beginning. 8 abortion doctors, including one in Toronto, and 2 in Mexico, were assassinated. Crossing international borders and jurisdictions hid the connection. And then came a night of explosions from Vancouver through Seattle and down into California, 42 pornographic theaters and stores demolished, lighting the night sky in half a dozen cities. A joint task force of FBI agents and RCMP officers was established to investigate these bombings, but even these would not make the link to the church burnings and assassinations. That would come much later. Very much later. Violence seemed to be the choice of the extreme right, bringing their agenda to the forefront of the nation's quixotic attention. And then a bomb rocked the streets of Washington, D.C., and when the noise and quaking of its violence had settled, only a crater remained of the national headquarters of the ACLU. Of the staff and volunteers working that day, only 3 would be pulled out of the rubble alive. Chapter 1. What was it like to wake up and find a stranger staring at you in the mirror? This new face was quite plain, and he liked it that way. How many times, he wondered, must you change your identity before you forget who you are? Did he even remember his boyhood? No, he shook his head sadly. That was too many lifetimes ago, too many names and faces. His eyes fell on the picture of a bright-eyed girl tucked into the corner of his mirror, and he smiled. He may not be a man with a past, but now he was a man with a future. And then he remembered. That was yesterday, before he saw the horror flashing across the screen of the television hanging above the bar. She was gone now, taken from him. Death was nothing new to him, it had always been a part of his life. His grief was not. He was known as Michael now, although he would wear neither this face, nor the name much longer. Michael was a freelance assassin, sometimes in the employ of the CIA, or Britain, or even Israel, or so the file in the basement of CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia claimed. He had come out of retirement at the urging of his handlers for the beginning of the War on Terror, and would retire a second time after discovering he had a daughter. For 5 years he had watched her grow into a woman, always remaining in the shadows, seeing but unseen. Michael had made enemies over the years, and while no one could know where or who he was, it was too dangerous to include mother and child in his life. While the CIA file did not list his current whereabouts, he was thought to be somewhere in Canada because it was easier to cross borders with its passport, a passport often used by intelligence agencies for exactly this reason. It was also the country where his only daughter had lived until she had moved to the United States to attend university. The file in Langley did not contain this last bit. It was one of many things unknown about this man. His country of origin was a mystery, and it was so long since he had thought about the land of his birth that he too had forgotten it. Some analysts within the intelligence community thought he might be an Israeli, or maybe from one of the Balkan nations. This was speculation based on one of the dozen languages he spoke with the flawless accent of a native. In the end, British, American, and Israeli intelligence had taken to calling him the physician because of the surgical skill with which he took out a target. Most had been terrorists or drug lords. There had been a politician or two, and once he had targeted a nuclear scientist in Pakistan believed by the Israelis to be passing information on to the Iranians. But the physician was not political. Nor was he a sociopathic killer. He had been known to walk away from contracts, both private and government, when he felt the killings were unwarranted. He had a unique skill, however, and sometimes there were evil people, men and women without whom the world was a better, safer place. Michael paused, remembering his first sight of his daughter. He was hiding behind a bus shelter, pretending to read a magazine as she and a group of her friends had turned the corner. Blonde-haired, like her mother, she had a smile that warmed the day, even in the bitter cold of February. Her laughter, which came easily, spilled like music from her lips. She was so beautiful and so full of life. Mary, the mother of his child, was an aid worker in Africa when they had met and had a brief affair 21 years ago. He had been in the area searching for his latest target, a rival warlord in one of the perennial conflicts that gripped that part of the world. The man's conversion to the Muslim faith and his association with Al-Qaeda had put him on the CIA's radar. The attack on the United States mining operation had placed him dead center in the scope of Michael's rifle. During his month-long hunt for his target, the couple had spent almost every evening together in a dusty, small village with only one cafe and a few broken-down cows. When the two had gone their separate ways, the physician knew nothing of the child that would be born 8 months later, and would remain ignorant of her existence until shortly after her 16th birthday. He had learned of her birth after an accidental meeting with a colleague of Mary's, a Swedish doctor who would win a Nobel Peace Prize for his work with organizations such as Doctors Without Borders. Both were in a backwater airport somewhere in northern Africa, seeking a flight out of the country ahead of a recent military coup. "Samuel," Dr. Borg greeted, "what a surprise. How is Mary? And your daughter? She must be what, 15 now?" He was traveling under the name of Franklin at the moment, and while any ghosts from his past could be dangerous, the airport was deserted with the exception of 24 Europeans and North Americans. The chance meeting had not disturbed him. "Fine," the physician returned, hiding his shock behind a smile. "I have a daughter. In fact, I am hoping to get home in time for her birthday. Hasn't been a damn plane land here in 2 days," Dr. Borg complained. "And not a damn person here to ask what is going on, but I called my embassy and they instructed us to remain at the airport. I suggest we all hop on the first plane that lands," Samuel replied, sharing a worried look with the doctor that was as fake as his smile. The physician knew an Air Lufthansa jet was due in another 4 hours, and he also knew he would be on it. As soon as his mission was over and the money wired into his account, the physician had headed to Canada. A contact he sometimes used when hunting targets in North America had tracked Myra through her social insurance number, and from there Michael did what he did best. From the day he had first seen Rachel, his sunshine on a frosty day, Michael had fallen in love. Staying in the shadows, he would watch her grow from a gangly teenager into a beautiful young woman. And now that woman lay dead, buried beneath a pile of smoldering rubble in a crater in Washington, D.C. Michael had been tempted to approach his daughter on many occasions, especially after Myra had died in a car accident shortly after Rachel's 18th birthday. His career made contact too dangerous for the child. Better no one in this world knew that they were connected, not even the child herself. And all his caution had meant nothing. He walked through the week while waiting for her body to be released like a zombie. Wrap it up in whatever flavor of patriotism or politics you chose, he was a killer. It was his only real skill. Whether hiding in the verdant jungles of Asia, or the concrete jungles of New York, Michael would hunt his targets down and end their life with a bullet to the head. He had never needed to salve his conscience. He may have first started out seeking justice and revenge, may have continued his work for the money, but the truth was he took pride in his skill. When necessary, he could make a death look like an accident. And when a target was thought to be unreachable, he felt a deep sense of accomplishment when he eliminated his man and still escaped with his life. And there was always a challenge to this type of work, no matter how easy or hard the target made his job. Michael had never faced the morality of his profession until his own child lay dead. And now? Now he was 50 and recently retired. Wet work was being phased out by most governments, although it had experienced a brief renaissance after 9/11, when so many terrorists had a price on their heads. The truth was he was getting too old. Assassinations were a young man's game, where quick reflexes and perfect eyesight were needed if one wished to live to see another mission. And neither his eyesight nor his reflexes were what they had been even 10 years ago. As he stared at a fresh grave, he wished he could have those 10 years back. Michael knew he could not do what he planned, not now, not at his age. He would have to recruit and train a team of younger people, and he knew exactly where he would find them. And so he would reinvent himself as the Pied Piper, the shaper of young, supple tools who would be the instruments of his revenge. 8 days earlier. Once, everyone loved their country, especially this one. Only oddballs and misfits didn't. In fiction and the cinema of Hollywood, every villain denounced the red, white and blue, and that was your cue to hiss and boo. Western democracies were becoming less inclusive, and had forgotten how to share their wealth. The American dream was no longer for everyone. People were not only turning against the government, they were turning against any and all governments. And that's where his job came in. At 2 a.m. on a smoky Wednesday morning, Special Agent Javier Hernandez was assigned to head up a multi-jurisdictional force tasked with investigating the ACLU bombing. Sipping tepid coffee, he stood at the rim of the rubble-filled crater that had been its national headquarters. He had already been on site for 4 hours. In the growing light, he watched an EMS team carry a blanket-draped body from the rubble, firemen in the background damping down hot spots. It had been 3 hours since they had rescued any survivors, and there was little hope of finding more. The fire had seen to that. Barriers and yellow police tape bordered the site, and the forensic teams were combing through the rubble for pieces of the explosive device, a search that was delayed from time to time as rescue teams dug through the rubble. So far, over 30 different organizations, domestic and international, real and fictional, had claimed responsibility. And each of these claims had to be investigated. Special Agent Hernandez was a big believer in psychological profiling, but standing here at ground zero, he would never understand what could make anyone do this. Already the media were referring to it as the worst terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11. And maybe they were right. Contrary to those media reports, this was actually the third bombing of an ACLU office. The first had been planted in the wrong building after the ACLU office had relocated 2 weeks earlier, and the second had failed to detonate due to a faulty lead. It was this undetonated bomb that had allowed FBI forensic teams to link these to the 42 bombings of the pornographic theaters. And that link had landed all 45 on his desk in the domestic terrorism department. Who were they? What was their mission? And where had they come across such sophisticated explosives? Of all the groups currently on the FBI and Homeland Security radar, few seemed to have the resources to pull something like this together. Several might have been large and organized enough to plan it, if they could find the money. On the black market, the Semtex used in the first two bombs alone would cost thousands, and if it was used here, tens of thousands. 45 bombs, plus the expertise to assemble them, represented a large investment, and unless these funds were coming from offshore, the BRICS nations being the most likely candidates, someone with money to burn had stepped onto the stage. Although this was not the first bombing, it was early days yet, and Special Agent Hernandez admitted it was all guesswork. Eventually, they would link a series of abortion doctor assassinations and church burnings to this campaign of terror. These people were sending a message to America. The bailout of the banks was the Harper's Ferry of a new civil war, and they were General Lee's men leading the way. How did any country go from winning the space race to having the feel of a third world nation? Even the capital was bankrupt, many of its neighborhoods no longer having basic services like garbage collection, fire and ambulance. Special Agent Hernandez, whose father was an illegal immigrant given his citizenship in one of the many amnesties, could see the tarnish on the American dream. The rich were getting richer, and there was no longer very much in between them and the desperately poor. Even his drive to this crime scene had carried him through several neighborhoods whose houses stood empty and boarded up, soon to be the homes of vagrants and squatters. Some of the banks that once held their mortgages were no longer around, bought out by others after they had failed, or disappearing like the middle-class families who once lived here. Neither question could be answered here, especially the main one that was burning in his mind. Unraveling that mystery was his job, his and a team from across a dozen organizations from three countries. Despite everything, Special Agent Hernandez suspected the answer to those questions lay here, in the heart of the USA. In places like its Bible Belt, and the backwoods of New Jersey and Michigan, places where dissatisfied veterans joined groups like the Posse Comitatus, the Armed Forces of National Liberation, and even the Aryan Nation, and where the manufacturing plants of Ford and GM were rapidly being replaced by meth labs. He only had to look to the national elections, where the president was often elected by one or two states, to see the growing rift in this nation between the left and right. Very few issues were not divisive, even mild ones like national health care, and no matter what the government proposed, there were always those ready to proclaim it a plot. This was the age of conspiracy, where everyone took the 60s rallying cry to question authority to ludicrous heights. A plane could not fall from the sky without dozens claiming it had been shot down by a government missile, terrorist attacks were planned by the White House or the Pentagon, or maybe by the CIA, and even the post office was part of Big Brother's efforts to control the world. Who needed the Illuminati when there were dozens of homegrown bureaucracies to fill their role? Only a few short years ago, those who saw fluoride in the water as a mind control experiment were seen as crazies. Today these same people were afforded the reverence of prophets. It was a different world than the one his father and grandfather grew up in. More dangerous and unstable, and people were pointing their fingers at everyone, including their neighbors. Was it big business or big government? The answer to that question depended on what side of the political street you stood. Was it illegal immigration or child labor in Asia and Africa? Well, Special Agent Hernandez had to admit, despite his own political leanings, it was a little of everything. But mostly, it was an erosion of belief in government, in the people of this country, and in the political process of this and every other democracy. Special Agent Hernandez turned his eyes back to the charred hole and its rubble. The rescue workers, up from a mine site in Virginia, had just uncovered another body. Working through the night under bright spotlights, these volunteers shifted concrete and steel beams with all the care of an artist rendering his masterpiece, and came away carrying yet another black body bag. Her body would be the last they recovered from the site, a young college student who had come across the border from Canada for her education, one of three foreign volunteers who died here. It would be the job of his investigation team, once the MEES lab made the identification, to notify her next of kin. They would not find any. Her mother, her only relative, had died 3 years earlier. And still, the money to return her body home and for her funeral had come from somewhere. It would not become important until much later in the investigation. But then, not even the FBI could see into the future. At least, not yet. That should be the last body, Juanita Gomez commented as she ghosted up to his side. If the list the ACLU gave us is correct. I want a full court press to find those bomb parts, Javier replied. Authorize all the overtime you need. I want the parts identified and agents tracking them by the end of the weekend. They caught us with our pants down and we are not the only agency that is looking stupid right now. I'll call in both day shifts, Juanita replied. This was Washington. Quantico was only next door, where the FBI main labs were located in Langley, Virginia. Finding enough bodies would not be a problem. Any word yet on the fragments from the other bombs? He asked. We only have 45 of the buggers. Hey, Juanita shrugged. I'm just a field tech. I gather the pieces and put them in little envelopes for the hot shots in the lab. He gave her a look and she laughed. Almost everything they found was generic. Nothing stood out. These were what you could call Walmart specials despite their sophistication. It's how they were put together that will tell us something. Shit. Javier breathed. We need a break on this one. We're not even picking up any chatter, not us, not NSA, no one. Sooner or later they will make a mistake, Juanita offered lamely, they always do. Special Agent Hernandez knew they were thinking the same thing. How many bodies would they leave behind before they made that mistake? From this point on the targets would have to be larger if they wanted to attract the media attention of this one, if publicity was their goal. The fact was his team had no inkling of their motivation. There were no internet blogs, at least none their cyber unit could find, no press releases, no whispers from the network of informants they had taken years seeding through the many organizations on their radar. Once in a while an organization, or even an individual, like the Unabomber, sprang out of nowhere, and those in law enforcement had to start from scratch. And even in these days of computers and forensics, DNA and databases, sometimes it came down to old-fashioned shoe leather. Agents of the FBI and Homeland Security were rounding up the usual suspects, checking their network of CIS, tracking rumors and shadows from one coast to another. The problem with looking for money when you had no idea of the source was that billions of dollars crossed the world, both along legal and illegal channels. Even with a large team of forensic accountants working around the clock, there was little for them to do besides speculating. Domestic terrorism was the hardest to track, and sometimes these groups linked up with international enemies for a variety of reasons. And when they did not seek publicity for their cause, as even the Unabomber had, the task was impossible. Did anything they had accomplished so far require that much money? Nothing. Except the bombs. These bombs could not have been wired in someone's basement with a copy of the anarchist's Bible, and while the amount of explosives involved in all but this last one could have disappeared from a dozen industrial sites, the quantity was staggering. Sometimes the paperwork was too much, or maybe just enough to make it easy to ignore the disappearance of one or two sticks of dynamite or a little C2. Or sometimes the person responsible for the inventory at the mine, or the construction site, was a member of whatever group wanted it. Minor discrepancies were the hardest to uncover, but the FBI and its federal and state counterparts would. 45 bombings in less than 2 months meant they were dealing with a large and well-organized group, and eventually someone amongst their ranks would start bragging. When that happened, the FBI or one of their informants had to be there. And to make sure they did not miss this opportunity, Special Agent Hernandez was on his way to talk the deputy agent into releasing some serious reward money. It was time this nation dealt with its domestic terrorists the same way it did foreign ones, with blood and money. Reward money played a major role in the United States war on terrorism, and it had led to the arrest or death of many in their deck of most wanted. Although he had never been a fan of public appeals, law enforcement could not survive without their tips. Nor was he above asking for a little assistance. It was a myth that law enforcement agencies were jealous of their jurisdiction. They were professionals with limited budgets and resources who would take anything they could get. Especially if that help was on somebody else's dime. And Javier's ego was not so all-encompassing that he forgot about the bigger picture, both the grieving families of the victims and the security and safety of the public. He would gladly accept the aid of Homeland Security, and of the NSA and the other intelligence agencies who were taking the hunt global, and from the local police forces who were even now working their network of informers. It would take all their resources to stop their nation's bleeding.